Well, we're all unshaven and
so it's probably
the same here.
I was going to say, imagine that we look just amazing.
Oh, there you are. I see you.
I look about the same as I always do.
Thank you for being on the show today. We are gonna keep our swearing to a minimum.
Go ahead and swear away.
Why look at me, Craig? What do I do?
Hello, Secret Movie Clubbers, and welcome to Secret Movie Club Podcast 25, our quarter centennial. Is there a better way to call episode 25?
We've lived our podcast a quarter hundred at a time.
Yeah, they're nice, nice. Today, and so Connor just set us up. Today's theme is cars, chases, and cinema. We actually have a special guest on the show breaking the monotony of the tyranny of our four voices. Who do we have on the show today? Who is our special guest?
Dave Tindall.
A.K.A.
Daniel's father-in-law.
Boom. I just want to say, Mr. Tindall, that all Daniel does in our pre-show is rave about you.
Yeah, every episode.
Good job, Daniel.
What a get. We were going to have Vin on, but we were like, no, we can't.
We actually had to boot him. Yeah, I had to make that call a half hour ago and tell Vin Diesel he was off the track because we had Dave Tindall. And Vin was cool about it. He was like, oh, you got Tindall? I was like, yeah. He's like, I understand. Dave is going to be talking. We're going to be talking about American Graffiti and sort of 50s, 60s, 70s car culture. Who else do we have on the show?
Hello, it's Daniel.
Vroom, vroom, it's Connor.
It's me, another day in America, watching movies and kicking ass.
And I'm Craig, the founder programmer of Secret Movie Club. Some of the movies we're going to be talking about today, guys, just so you know, is for some reason, cars are such a central part of a lot of our favorite movies. Not just that they're there and someone gets in a car, but literally today we're going to be talking about American Graffiti, Mad Max Fury Road, The Road Warrior, the Fast and the Furious franchise, Repo Man, Drive, and I'm sure a few other car movies will come. But all those movies, one of the main characters, are the cars. I heard George Miller, the director of the Mad Max movies, say that movies are movement. That's why you call them movies. And while people will say, yeah, 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 if you really think about it, and George Miller's one who would know because he's made great movies, the movies we love for some reason, they really do have a lot of dynamic movement. Car movies just inherently, if they're done well, have a lot of dynamic movement. So that may be one reason. So this upcoming weekend, Labor Day weekend, we are doing monster movies. So we would love to come have you join us at Parking Lot Cinema. We know for sure as of today that we are for sure going to do King Kong versus Godzilla, 1980s The Blob, Steven Spielberg's classic Jaws, and the 1990s Tremors. Those are for sure. So if you want to come see those monster movies, please join us. We may be adding a few more titles. It just depends on, as Daniel and Edwin will attest, our Cars, Chases, and Cinema weekend, which just ended, like for Daniel and I at 1 a.m. yesterday, literally, it's still the same day for Daniel and I. So it was a heck of a weekend. I don't know. Edwin, Daniel, are you still feeling it in your bones?
Yeah.
I felt 30 this morning for the first time when I woke up with like an ache in my back. Like, oh, all right.
That was funny to me. I thought, see, I'm 43. So I was like, oh, that's great. You felt 30. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Wait till you're 60.
Hey, Craig.
Yeah, Edwin.
It looks like I'm going to bail out now because apparently my ride's here.
Okay.
I'll just say this quick thing about Death Proof. It's one of the greatest car chase movies of all time. Screw CGI cars. Screw Fast and Furious. It's all about Death Proof. Take that, Connor.
What?
Mic drop. The ultimate. That's the ultimate Edwin appearance.
I'm cutting all of you out.
You cut me out? You cut God out, man.
Oh, Edwin. What? You keep
that's making... That's what I just did. That's what I just did, man.
We'll see you at the next podcast.
Take care, Edwin.
Take care, man.
Bye, Edwin. Okay, so
I'm pissed.
that was Edwin Gomez. Now his appearances, he's getting so big. We always knew Edwin was going to blow up, but at least we got him for those few minutes. But anyway, Monster Movies, Labor Day weekend, we'd love to have you. And then, as always, if you have any comments, you can write us at community@secretmovieclub.com and podcast@secretmovieclub.com. And that's it. Let's keep it short. Main topic, cars, chases, and cinema. We are going to start by talking to Dave Tindall about one of the great car movies, American Graffiti, which really, when I think about graffiti, It's the first day of summer for all of these high school graduates and people who are a little older in Modesto, California. And like a lot of small town America, I have to imagine, their main source of entertainment is getting in the car and just driving around the main strip on a Friday or Saturday night, whether or not they have anything to do or a date or not. And so the movie really becomes an ode to how cars are independence. Cars are the first chance that teenagers get to flirt with other teenagers, also get out their aggression, also get in trouble, also their first ways of showing their identity because they take such good care of their cars.
Well, for me, American Graffiti was huge. I think it came at just the right time, too. I was growing up being really interested in cars. My dad was a car guy. He worked with his hands a lot, and he taught me how to work on cars. And we had just moved to Detroit from the East Coast, and I was super excited. We were moving to the Motor City, and it was going to be, you know, cool cars. I was probably 13 or 14 when I saw American Graffiti, maybe 13. And like you said, it resonated because it was what I wanted to be doing. I wanted to be cruising. I wanted to, you know, be out looking for girls. It was high school or junior high at the time for me. I don't know. It just resonated at the perfect time for me to connect with it.
When you were coming up, when you were growing up in the 70s, could you really, like, I'm a native Los Angelino, and so in a weird way, I take for granted, I've always seen actors on the street. I've always seen movie premieres. LA has, like, however many movie theaters, even though, I mean, right now, obviously, we're shut down because of COVID. But they're just always, LA has always been an industry town. You just took it for granted that it was the movie industry. Could you feel that when you were in Detroit? Were there just cars and billboards and everything everywhere?
Definitely. It's car carriers and trains picking up cars, and Ford Motor Company and Chrysler and GM all have their headquarters right here. So everybody works for the car companies pretty much. So everybody drives new cars, and it's kind of a weird place because of that. You don't see as many old cars because the new cars are just constantly being brought in, and the designers are here, and everything kind of circulates around car culture. And I saw American Graffiti, and everything was so cool about it. I wanted to have something unique. I'd always been drawing cars and drawing hot rods and kind of had an art interest. So after seeing American Graffiti, I wanted to find the Deuce Coupe that Milner drives in American Graffiti, and it probably took me about a year to find one in the ads. Back then, you went through newspaper ads and looked for cars, and I had no money, of course. I was cutting lawns, I think, but I found a car in a town south of here. It was $800. It totally emptied my bank account. I think my parents thought I was crazy, but a guy trailered this Hulk back to our house, and it was a 1932 Ford that had been chopped and channeled, old hot rod terms, back in the 50s sometime. And I spent about the next year, I still didn't have my license yet. So they looked at the car and they figured, oh, this is safe because he's never going to get this thing on the road. So it'll be a safe project. But it took me about a year, and I got it all rebuilt and painted and get a vehicle back in running order and legal. I got it together and then started driving it to high school. And it was kind of our own little American Graffiti. It's a 32 Ford with flames and a big block Buick engine in it.
So when you say that, because I actually don't, I know exactly the car you're talking about, American Graffiti. It's the one that Paul...
Yeah, the yellow car.
That Paul LaMatt drives around, the yellow car.
Exactly.
But when you say chopped and channeled, does that mean it was kind of Frankenstein?
Yeah, well, it was a customizing technique started back in the 50s where they chop a section out of the top 2 or 3 inches to lower the top and give it a more raked look to it, more stylized a little bit. And then channeling it is dropping the whole body of the car down over the frame. So you're lowering the whole car. And so that had been done by some customizers back quite a while ago.
And do you do that for speed and for handling?
Yeah, I guess it would help too for somebody that was actually racing it. Like with you guys being in LA, for us, even though we had Detroit and all the car companies, we always looked to Los Angeles and Southern California as the epitome of car culture, because you guys could do it all year round. You had the dry lakes where the guys in the 40s and 50s coming back from World War II were racing these kind of cars on the dry lakes. We always looked towards you guys. All the coolest cars in the magazines were all coming out of Southern California, and still are to some extent.
Three of the five movies we showed this weekend were set in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
The other two were set in a hell world.
But it's funny what you're saying, Dave, because it, my dad was a big fan of 50s and 60s music, and I never thought about it growing up, even though I loved music. But all the music is like Little Deuce Coupe, all the Beach Boys songs. They're all about cars. Now, did you name your car once you got it built?
Yeah.
What was your name?
Classic Gas, after the Mason Williams song, Classical Gas.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, because the style of car, certain style of car is called a gasser. Mine wasn't exactly that, but it's where they would have a straight front axle with almost no suspension, large tires on the back, and the car would be kind of tilted at an angle.
So, Dave, if you're comfortable talking about it, once you built that thing up and you were driving it, you do any racing?
You know, my license was so highly regarded. Having my license, it was like keeping it in a glass container somewhere, that I was always super nervous that I was going to lose my license. I did get pulled over a lot in the car, but never got a ticket for racing. We'd do burnouts and things. I would always do a burnout out of the high school parking lot, but nobody ever bothered me for it.
Good answer. I'm a cop.
Oh, okay. What's a burnout?
Oh, just where you rev it up. And if it's a manual transmission, you dump the clutch. You let out the clutch really fast, and it spins the tires. And it makes a lot of noise, and it's smoky. And
leaves skid marks.
Yeah, leaves skid marks, yeah.
There's a video game franchise.
I know you guys did Evil Dead, talk about Evil Dead a while back. I was also lucky to be here with all those guys in high school. I went to high school with Bruce and Sam Raimi and a whole bunch of other guys. And I was thinking that I might have seen American Graffiti with Bruce Campbell.
Wow.
At that point, because we all lived together kind of in the same area, suburban area north of Detroit. And my dad would take us to the movies, and we saw a bunch of movies in that time period before we had licenses. So, you know, we'd all get together and go to the movies and saw a bunch of stuff like that. And so it's kind of cool.
Well, that's hugely cool. And Connor, I think, Connor, your favorite movie is Evil Dead, right?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, no, I remember hearing about this fact before and freaking out a little bit.
Well, you know, it was funny because we would see Bruce, you know, every day in high school in the halls, and he'd be doing his little shtick things. They were really big into, one of those guys. The Three Stooges. Three Stooges were huge. So they started out just mimicking Three Stooges type stuff, and then we'd watch their homemade movies at lunchtime in the high school, and it was fun. But so those guys would be out cruising too, and in fact Bruce would sneak up to my house at night. I'd be working on my car in the garage, and we had a long driveway, and he would park someplace down the street, sneak up to the garage, and scare the life out of me while I'm working on my car. And it's just the way Bruce was. He just loved doing those kind of wacky things.
Did you know Sam Raimi at all, or do you have any Sam Raimi stories?
Sam, I only knew him. See, he was a year younger, so we weren't really around each other in high school that much. He did live near Bruce, but yeah, didn't really know Sam as much until later. I went to the premiere for Evil Dead, which was in Royal Oak. It was in an art theater in Royal Oak, but then they were calling it Book of the Dead when they were first showing it to the investors, doctors and lawyers and stuff like that.
Yeah, a producer wanted them to change it because they were like, Book of the Dead, people are going to think you're going to have to read.
I can't let that pass. That's amazing, Dave. So not only did you fix up cars, you also were at the premiere of Evil Dead.
Yeah.
What was your reaction to it? Because we all know it, you know, I'm 43, I'm older than these guys, but we all know it as, I even knew it as a classic when I was a kid.
Uh-huh. Well,
and that would have also have been like a much different cut than the one we know now.
Probably, yeah, I bet it would be.
Because the title was different and the sound was basically completely redone, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it had to have been a pretty early version. The theater was packed. They had lots of people there, all the investors that they were able to string together to put it together. I had a pin. They gave out little pins to everybody there that said Book of the Dead on it. And I should still have it. I don't have it anymore. I was an instructor at the College for Creative Studies in Detroit for a few years. And I had a student that was so into Evil Dead that I gave him the pin. And he thought it was the greatest thing to have this memoir from the original movie.
That's incredible. I think at that premiere, there's like a story in Bruce's book where he says like it cost them $100 to rent the theater, and they sold 101 tickets for $1, so they literally made like a profit of $1 or something like that.
It was a fun time. All their movies. They would borrow our cars. They borrowed my dad's old MG, which we still have, 1950 MG, and that's one time I do remember Sam Raimi. They were out in West Bloomfield on some open roads, and they were filming some kind of it was like a Springtime for Hitler kind of a weird takeoff movie, and the car kind of looks like an old SS car with the big fenders and headlights, and they were sitting in the back and I was driving the car, and I don't know whether anything ever happened to that film, but
well that's so you were in a Sam Raimi movie.
I guess it must have been an early Sam Raimi movie. We in the city of Birmingham, which is another really nice suburb nearby, they would use some of the back alleys and film back there. I was actually in one of the movies with Bruce, and I had a couple of lines, and I think he felt that I was not going to be an actor, so that was the last of him asking me to be in the movies, actually speaking.
So now moving on, and Dave, we want you in on the convo if you want to keep going. You want to keep hanging with us, or do you need to do something?
I'll hang. Yeah, I'll hang if you don't mind me here.
What order? I was thinking. Do we have an order in mind, Craig?
I almost would be inclined for you to go about Fast and Furious, if that's okay.
So I know nothing about car culture. I know zero about it. I like these movies more from a pure movie point of view, so I don't know if we have any like actual things to talk about it from car culture. I'm going to instead give a brief history of these movies, because if you don't know the things that these movies do, it's very... I really like just explaining these movies to people and seeing them just slowly be like, what?
And so we should lead in that we showed the original Fast and the Furious this past weekend, which was made in 2001, about drag racing and thieves in Los Angeles.
It's essentially Point Break, but with drag racing.
I never thought of it that way. You're right.
And how many sequels have there been, Connor?
There is 9 in total now.
So take it away, Connor.
I want to preface this with saying that I found this out recently, that Paul Walker was kind of a creep. Not kind of, definitely a creep, and dated some underage girls. That's the extent of it. There is no specific allegations of abuse, and they seem to have had positive relationships with him later. So I don't know. It's weird and bad. But I just want to say that because, one, the Luciferian lamplight of truth spares no shadows.
I still want to believe that's an original quote. Did you just come up with that?
No, I didn't.
Aww.
And then also, just so people aren't, because I'm about to speak very positively of Paul Walker, and I don't want someone being like, hey, you know, I just want to put that out there.
I learned that too. I didn't know about the whole Rob Cohen director thing. And we learned about that. Someone had to tell me that the director of the first Fast and the Furious has some really serious and horrible allegations against him. So let's just say that as we get further and further, there are going to always be very complicated backstories to some of the filmmakers. But we're just talking about the series and the movie.
But the Fast and the Furious movie started with The Fast and the Furious, which I think is technically like there's like some older movie that's called The Fast and the Furious from like the 50s.
I found out about this in my research. It's just that Roger Corman owned the title to that.
Yeah, that's what I
thought. And they had all these names and they just didn't like any of the names. And they were like, we like The Fast and the Furious. So they actually gave Corman, I found this hilarious, Universal cut a deal where they said that Corman could use all their stock footage for free. And then Corman released the title.
I also want to preface this by saying, once again, Edwin doesn't know what he's talking about. And there is quite a bit of real cars. I'll mention this as I go through the movies. But during the filming of the first movie, 78 cars were wrecked both on and off screen. There is CGI in the films, one in particular. But there is also quite a bit of real stuff happening, more than you would think, especially in some of the later ones where they do some, I'll get there. So the first movie, very simple. Paul Walker is Brian O'Connor, who's this cop who's investigating this street racing scene that they think is tied into these thefts run by the head of this scene is Dominic Toretto, played by Vin Iron Giant Diesel. Also important in the first movie is Georgiana Brewster, who's his sister, Brian's love interest, and whose character name I don't remember. And Michelle Rodriguez as Letty, who plays Vin Diesel's love interest. But the first movie is actually probably one of my least favorite because it's kind of one of the more serious ones. It's a pretty straightforward kind of crime movie with the relationship between these two guys. There was then some issues. Like Vin Diesel had some weird stuff where he kind of dropped in and out of projects a lot in the mid-2000s. That happened with the XXX movies. There were some issues with the Riddick films, which was a franchise he desperately wanted to get off the ground because I think technically the character was based off a D&D character of his. Are there, maybe that was a different, there might be multiple Vin Diesel movies that are based off of D&D characters, but the second movie is Paul Walker again, and it's basically a buddy cop movie with him and Tyrese.
Directed by John Singleton, right?
I think so, yeah. It is a much lighter film. I think it's kind of a bad movie, but it's a bad in exactly the way I like a movie to be bad. It's very, very fun and light and basically feels like a it could be PG other than a couple of just bloodless but horrific acts of violence that come out of nowhere. There's a race and the people are goofing around and stuff. And they're on this road, and this one guy tries to go in between these two trailers, and they come together, and he gets bounced around between the two trailers and flipped under their wheels and crushed. And it's in the middle of all this goofy stuff. But Ludacris is also introduced in that one as a man who is good with tech. He's also good with cars, but everybody in all of these movies is good with cars. The third movie, which is chronologically the sixth movie, The Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift, is about nobody in the previous films. It's about this kid whose name I can't remember who gets in trouble for racing cars. So he gets sent overseas to live with his dad, who's an army guy who works in Tokyo. And it's kind of a coming of age story and a Yakuza thing. I actually think this one's really underrated.
Yeah, directed by Justin Lin.
Justin Lin, yeah. This was the first of four movies that he directed. I think he might be coming back to the series, actually. But I think Justin Lin is a very talented director, especially for action and these types of things. The main thing that Tokyo Drift does is introduce the character Han, who's a Chinese, seemingly someone on the run, who dies in Tokyo Drift but then comes back, which is why the chronology of the movies is what it is. The fourth movie, which is called Fast and Furious... they just dropped the's, is a reuniting of the main four characters in the first movie. And this one's probably the worst one. This one has a lot of CG. It's also one of the more serious ones. Again, it's one of the other serious ones. But it's just kind of a crime thing, kind of like the first one. But it leads into Fast Five, which is sort of the beginning of the second era of these films, when these films become true blockbusters and ensemble films, because in Fast Five, Vin Diesel's back, Paul Walker's back, Jordana Brewster's back, Michelle Rodriguez is not, though she does join later, Tyrese and Ludacris from the second one, Han from the third one, and Gal Gadot from the fourth one, who this was pre-Wonder Woman for her, and a few other characters as well from these films.
But not The Rock yet.
No, well, The Rock's the bad guy in Fast Five.
Oh.
But he's not the bad, bad guy. He's the guy on the other side of the law type of bad guy, where he's trying to chase them down, but they have some respect. And the fifth one is a heist movie where they're stealing from this drug lord in Rio. And there's a sequence towards the end where Vin Diesel and Paul Walker are driving these two cards and they attach wires to a vault and are pulling it through the street, and they did that. they had like a person, like there was a car built into it that was driving around drifting, like smashing through debris. And that movie's probably the best one. That or Fast and Furious 6, which is the name of the sixth one, which is basically a superhero movie, basically about them going after an evil crew. Like it's like a bad guy, and it's literally like a group of dudes who like align with each of them.
Oh, so there's like an evil Dom, an evil Paul.
Yeah, exactly.
An evil Ludacris.
Yeah, 100%. That's what that movie is. It's that one's actually my favorite of them. And there's like a scene... Again, they really did this where they a bunch of their cars show down with a tank, and they're just driving on this road and like driving up on a tank and stuff.
Is the sub on the frozen lake? Is that seven?
No, that's eight.
Oh, okay.
So the seventh one, Furious Seven, with the seven spelled out. This was the one that was being filmed when Paul Walker passed away, which was a legitimate tragedy, an awful way to go. Because of that, it's kind of a Frankenstein of a movie, especially if you rewatch it. You can kind of see the seams for how they had to like figure out how to put his character in it. And more than anything, it's kind of like a farewell to him, like a very genuine farewell. Like you can tell, like specifically Vin Diesel has a lot of creative control over those movies. And it was literally him just like saying goodbye to his friend, which makes the movie very emotional. They also drop cars from a plane at one point in the movie, which they actually did.
I read that. How did they, do you know how they did that stunt? Like where did the cars land? They didn't like shock any farmers or schools below. They must have figured out where those cars were going to.
They were spotters keeping on an eye. They had parachutes on the cars. And they just had like people everywhere to make sure that they didn't land on someone.
So, and they bring in Tony Jaa from Ong Bak and The Protector as a villain.
Yeah, well, so basically what happens is this in the sixth one, Luke Evans is the main bad guy. He's like the leader. He's the evil Dom. At the end of that one, we reveal that Jason Statham is his brother and he killed Han in the third one, which is why, which is what puts Tokyo Drift chronologically sixth. And so the seventh one is about Jason Statham and Vin Diesel kind of going at each other with very personal, because they both sort of have affected each other's crew or their families.
So when does Statham become a good guy in The Rock?
In the eighth one.
Oh, okay.
Every bad guy in the next movie becomes a good guy, typically. So The Rock becomes a good guy in the sixth one, and then Statham is the bad guy in the seventh and becomes a good guy in the eighth one. And I'm assuming Charlize Theron is going to become a good guy in the ninth one.
Then The Rock and Statham got their own spinoff.
Yeah, that's also one of the weaker ones. It's kind of a buddy cop movie. I want to mention really quickly that the eighth one, which is called The Fate of the Furious, which is one of the best titles a movie has ever had, is basically a James Bond movie, kind of. There's a part where Charlize Theron's character hacks all the cars in a city, and like there's like a parking garage, and they shoot all the cars down, like raining cars off the building. Again, they actually did that. That movie also introduces Charlize Theron and Helen Mirren as Jason Statham's mother.
Whoa! And what's the one coming out before you stop?
I'm not sure what the ninth one's called. I think right now they're just calling it F9, and I'm not sure what it's going to be, because you never really know what these are going to be until you. I feel like I watch them, and then I'm kind of like, oh, okay, this one's a Bond movie. This one's a superhero movie. I do lament, not just because of the horrible way to go, but Paul Walker, I do think he gave the movies a kind of a dopey charm. I don't necessarily know if he was a good actor, but I think he has a lot of charisma. I worry because apparently, you know, because Vin Diesel and The Rock are now essentially the two main stars, and apparently they don't get along with each other. It feels a little bit like I can see these becoming, I don't know, Fate was a little more serious, and Hobbs and Shaw, the spinoff, was a little too, like, lightweight, I feel like. Even though that one also introduced, like, Idris Elba was, like, a guy with, like, superpowers, essentially. So these movies are eventually going to go to space. I can't wait.
Well, and for context, Connor, because some people actually might not know it, could you just briefly talk about how Paul Walker died?
Yeah, Paul Walker, during the production of Furious 7, during a break, him and I forget who the other person was, they were at some sort of event and they were driving a car, and it got into an accident and they died in the accident. And yeah, awful.
Yeah, no, I remember that. Obviously, every death is different, and I don't even know how to really talk about it here, and it's a much heavier topic than really we have the time to get into. But when that happens to a Paul Walker or a Chadwick Boseman, if people are listening to this, the actor Chadwick Boseman, star of Black Panther, Jackie Robinson, James Brown, The Five Bloods, just passed away after a long battle at 43 with colon cancer. Kobe Bryant in the helicopter accident. It always reminds me, I was just thinking about this earlier today, that there are just no guarantees. And I think that we tend to live life not wanting to think about that any day something could happen. And usually it doesn't. That's sort of the miracle of life, is usually it doesn't. But I just, you know, Paul Walker was what, late 30s, early 40s?
He was 40.
That just reminds you that there are just, when somebody is rich or is famous or whatever, they can't prevent it. It just gets you. So I've never seen any of the Fast and Furiouses until yesterday when we did Fast and Furious 1. And I'll make my comments short. But is there anything you just want to say about all of it? And then I'll throw it to Daniel and Dave.
It's one of my favorite current franchises because I think more than anything, it's very earnest. It's not a series that's trying to be what it isn't. It fully knows itself. And I think maybe that's one of the maybe most important things you can do in your life is to know yourself. I'm not going to argue that these movies are high tier cinema necessarily, though I think some of the like Fast Five and Six are kind of close in terms of like the stunts.
I saw this when I saw the first one. My mom accidentally rented it on VHS when I was like 11 or 12. It was never my jam. And I saw the second one with some friends and again, wasn't my jam. And then cut to, I'm in Chicago for college. Fast and Furious Six is coming out. And the trailers for it are the moment on the highway with the tank, which the tank comes out of another vehicle, right? It like smashes through.
Yeah.
And then a moment where a car flies out of the front of a plane. And I was very confused by what I was seeing. And so moved to LA, Furious 7 comes out. Similar thing with the trailer. There's a shot in the trailer for Furious 7 where they drive a car between three buildings, right?
It's two buildings. I'm pretty sure this was CG.
That's fair, yeah.
It's two skyscrapers, and
like Dubai.
The car shoots out of one skyscraper and goes into the other.
And so my roommates and I, we binged them. And I think the first one is respectable, and I enjoy it. I think the second one is actively not my thing. The third one, I enjoyed moments of. The fourth one has the first moments of like traces where I'm like, okay, I kind of see what they're doing. And then five is unbelievable. And I don't understand what happened, how they got to five, and how the studio allowed that type of radical shift. Where it's the same heart and soul, but they finally realized that we can just make these insane, and you buy it somehow.
They got the tuning right.
Yeah. And I think also part of it, too, that is really interesting that I never thought about is the ensemble cast is predominantly not white. And it's sort of interesting as a franchise thing where there's now star power with The Rock and Vin Diesel. But at the time, like these were like Paul Walker and Vin Diesel weren't like big names yet. I think he was coming off of Pitch Black, and they also were like films of representation. Like it's this very close-knit family from Southern California, and they care about each other.
I think they are very like. There's like a statistic about them with like they're very popular with people of color. Like the percentages of that statistic is much higher for this franchise than a lot.
And it doesn't feel like it was anything done to like hit some type of quota. It feels it was genuinely they casted it to fit not only the culture that it takes place in, but who that represents. And
Dave, have you seen the Fast and Furious movies?
I've seen the first one and maybe the second one, but I'm anxious actually to see the series of them now after hearing Connor's discussion of them. It sounds intriguing. I think the thing that kind of turned me off a little bit was that it's a style of car, being the car guy, that I'm not really into too much. I know a lot of them were done with a style of car that they consider tuners, which is a more modern, mostly an imported car. And I probably didn't give it a chance, and I want to check it out. I know the later ones have a lot of CG in them, CGI in them, I don't know. You either like that or you don't, I guess. But
they do have CGI, but it's more for touch-ups. A lot of the stunts are actually done legitimately.
Really?
It's pretty insane how much wow. they do for real.
It's a lot more than you think.
And Vin Diesel's character is an American muscle car guy, so there's a character you can. He hates the imports, so he can relate to him.
I was gonna mention that the characters as it goes on start. getting like their own types of cars whenever they get cars, and Vin Diesel's are always like American muscle cars.
I actually need to rewatch Fast and Furious 1 because when we're doing these drive-ins, I'm always watching it out of the corner of my eye, and we're cleaning bathrooms, and we're apologizing to people that we've run out of space, and we're, you know, it's like everything. But what I got out of the movie, and I was able to see a decent part of it, it's just one of those things that gets me thinking. And what I want to share is, and this is going to be kind of a weird story, but I hope it goes to what Daniel and Connor were saying, was so we check everybody in when they come into the parking lot as a drive-in. And I was just seeing all these people of different races, different ages. You know, we had men, women, we had black families, Asian families, Hispanic families. And it really got me to thinking. I was like, well, they're all coming and they love this series. It's bringing them a lot of happiness. And then when the movie gets going, I saw all these people in their truck flatbeds and they're eating their food and eating their pizza, and friends had come with takeout. And I think sometimes when you're a movie maker and you go to film school, you have a tendency to poo-poo what you think are really mainstream or sellout movies, or they're only in it for a buck. And some of those movies are. I mean, I'm not trying to, there are a lot of movies that are just in for a buck, and you know them when you see them, because you're like, why did I just spend $15 on that movie? They got my money and I want it back. But I saw legitimate happiness, and I think that a lot of people had a great Sunday night. And it just, it's something I think that for filmmakers, you don't have to make that kind of movie, but it does help to be humble about it and aware of it, that some people want to go and see cool cars and Vin Diesel and Paul Walker and Jordana Brewster and Michelle Rodriguez and Ludacris and Tyrese, and they want to see some crazy stunts, and they want to laugh and get their mind off things and have this great time. And these movies are giving people like just a great dessert, a great dessert. So now we're going to move on. We showed Friday night two very car-oriented movies that would be considered a little, even though they were both mega hits, although Repo Man was a mega hit over time, Drive was definitely a mega hit in the theaters. We showed Alex Cox's 1984 debut feature Repo Man, which stars Emilio Estevez and is this punk rock reaction to Reagan's America. But it has this really crazy story of this punk rock kid who gets a job repossessing cars with this group of repo men who are just nuts. And at the same time, he encounters a woman who has conspiracy theories about an alien object in a car in downtown LA before it got renovated. So it's also weirdly, maybe unintentionally, this Valentine to LA of the early 80s. Drive was 2011, very recent, relatively, and it stars Ryan Gosling, directed by Danish director Nicholas, is he Danish or from the Netherlands? I got to look that up.
He's from one of those fantasy countries.
He's Danish.
The land of Lars von Trier has also produced Nicholas Winding Refn. And Drive was, I believe, his first American film. And it's basically a movie about a stunt driver in the day who is a getaway driver at night for thieves. He falls in love with his neighbor in his apartment building, played by Carey Mulligan. They start a sort of innocent romance because she's waiting for her husband to get out of jail. When he does, he's played by Oscar Isaac, and that leads to Gosling meeting this bad guy, kind of brilliantly played by Albert Brooks, and then things go crazy. Obviously, everything goes wrong, and then Ryan Gosling kicks up into vigilante sort of superhero territory. But it's a very dreamlike, mythical movie in LA about a sort of God's lonely man, Ryan Gosling, dealing with a romance he can't really have and then getting mega, mega violent. But they're very car-oriented movies for sure. And the cars are main characters. And yet, I would say of all the movies we're talking about, these are probably the most character-driven movies. And so weirdly, it's this subgenre of car movie where it's indie character-driven, and these characters have a very conflicted relationship with their cars, and we see conflicted characters. What did you guys think of these movies, anybody?
You mentioned sometimes, Craig, if a movie's in your top 35, and I haven't fully finalized mine, but I think Repo Man's probably in mine. It was the only one I got a chance to rewatch this week. It is, you know, a document of a time before my time, a time when you would have been a kid, Craig.
I was 7.
I don't know. I don't want to get too explicitly political, but I think about how some of the failings of that era have led to more and more failings as time has gone on. And watching this movie, it feels like a weird, weirdly prescient in certain ways, and like attitudes. And
that's a really great point, because the movie explicitly talks about how people get wrapped up in conspiracy theories versus facts, how people become slaves to their TV, and they watch someone on TV who's clearly a fake, probably, but they would rather believe in the lie. And then also the consumerism in the movie. There's a lot of weird stuff where you see seeds of what we're grappling with, what we've been grappling with as an American culture for 30 years, I think.
And it's also very funny. Not in a way that like makes me like laugh out loud a lot, but it's so strange. There's so many strange choices. And Harry Dean Stanton, who's the kind of co-lead, he kind of plays the main of the Repo Men, who kind of tutors.
He's the Obi-Wan Kenobi Repo Man.
He's incredible in this movie. I think maybe the funniest performance to me is the his friend, who goes into the crime. I forget his name. It's like Thud or something. It's something like that. And he's the one who's like, come on, we're going to go commit a crime. Things like,
is he the guy who dies at the end and he says, I blame society?
Yeah, he says, I blame society. And Emilio Estevez goes, I actually think these are actually very incredible lines, as he's dying over dramatically. And he says, I blame society. And Emilio Estevez says, that's BS. And he says, well, and he replies, well, it still hurts, and then dies. And I think there's something there about, you know, who's really to blame for what's the pain in the world. It's hard to pin, but it does always still hurt.
I only saw it for the first time a few years ago, and it's great, and it's perfect because it, especially from the cover, or just trying to unravel what it could be about, the first, like, few minutes of the movie are a cop pulling over a Chevy Malibu, and he opens the trunk, and this flash of light happens, and he's turned to skeleton and disappears.
Also, everything that happens in this movie has probably actually happened. I'm just gonna say this movie also tingles the genuine conspiratorial part of my brain.
It somehow worked because like that's the through line of it, but it's not quite the plot, because then you cut to like the Repo Man business, which I think is a really interesting thing. We sort of shows, I don't know if when you were growing up, Connor, if you ever watched, but shows like Dog the Bounty Hunter. Or like people that have these reality shows about these people that do things like this, and the type of person you need to be to like take on this model of like, well, the bank owns that and it's, you know, it's ours, which is like sort of horrifying. I don't know. It's really fascinating, and always it's the right type of weird where it's not off-putting weird. Some movies are so weird that it's hard to like share them with people, but this has this great balance of being sort of funny. Also, it has, there's like an aesthetic. There's this sort of punk aesthetic that I think like it captures really well, but at the same time, I think the biggest thing I like about this, about the film, is that the balance it finds with all of these things, that it never feels, it somehow never pushes too far in any direction. It always feels rooted in the story.
I love Repo Man. Repo Man is one of my favorite, I always say that Repo Man is one of my favorite cult movies, or so crazy it's good. But like Connor was saying, it's just one of my favorite movies. It's just, I've seen it numerous times. And one of the things I didn't realize, we had lead actress Olivia Barish actually speak, which was amazing. She came and she told stories ahead of the movie. And in talking to her, I thought the cinematographer on the movie is Robbie Mueller. And not to nerd out or geek out here, but Robbie Mueller has shot amazing things with Lars von Trier. He shot amazing things with Michael Winterbottom. He really is one of the great cinematographers of the last 30, 40 years. And what I discovered, and this is in no way a slight to the director Alex Cox, because he's admitted this himself, is actually the visual design of the film was Robbie Mueller's. Cox was a debut filmmaker out of UCLA. So he focused on the script and the performances. But whenever I watch Repo Man, it's like Big Lebowski to me. I always get more things. There's always things going on in the background. There's always an incredible sense of tone. It's an LA that I recognize, weirdly. It's the LA that I know. So I have to give it up for Robbie Mueller. And the other thing I'll say about Repo Man, and you guys have both hinted at it, is it's a miracle of tone. And tone, you know, I think when people think of tone in movies, they think, oh, that's one of the less important things, you know, character, story, effects, whatever. But actually, if your tone doesn't work, it's like tone of voice. If you talk to somebody in a tone of voice that off-puts them, they're not listening. And if you make a movie in a tone that people don't get, they're not watching. And Repo Man achieves this weird sci-fi, satire, comedy tone that is a miracle. So we showed Drive, which I am a huge fan of. I actually find as I get older, I'm really obsessed with Drive. And we already talked about what it's about. Probably my favorite Ryan Gosling movie, easily. I have to see Bronson because I haven't seen Bronson. But of the Nicholas Winding Refn movies I've seen, easily my favorite. Refn said this was a movie about a man lonely driving LA at night listening to pop music. And weirdly, even though it's a very violent film, that I think captures a vibe of, I think, a certain place you are in your life where you want a family, maybe. I know everybody doesn't. I'm not trying to put that on them. But maybe you worry as a man that you can't be a father, you can't be a husband. Maybe there are things that are wrong with you, and you're on the outside looking in at maybe a life you want that you're afraid you're not going to be able to have. And I think that the movie, oddly, as violent as it is, captures an aspect of masculinity that is pretty powerful to me. And the most devastating thing to me about the movie is that Gosling realizes he's not father and husband material. He realizes he's probably psychotic and violent and too unpredictable, and the best decision he can make is to stay away from the woman and her kid as much as he wants that. And that's a really powerful decision, that sometimes the best decision you make is not inserting yourself.
I also love Drive. It's another one of those movies in the weird spectrum of, I think, newer films that is misunderstood. Or I feel like when it came out when I was in film school, and very quickly became a lot of like film dude's favorite movie, but for reasons that are not really anything, like just in the cool factor, like the Scorpion jacket, or like this quiet, untalking protagonist, and less about sort of what it is kind of going for. It's sort of one of those that you're just, from minute one, I was in. Because once that, I think it's the Chromatics, once the song when he's in the car starts to play and it explains his rules, which is basically, you've got me for 5 minutes. In those 5 minutes, I'm yours. After that, I'm gone. And then it's just, I think Refn's, I have mixed feelings on some of his filmography, but in this, his understanding of how to build the tension before the violence or the action starts is sort of impeccable. And if you watch it, I highly recommend, even if people that watched it at the drive-in, watch it with headphones or on a really loud system, because the music and the sound design behind it really makes those scenes.
Moving on to the last two movies we'll talk about. So George Miller has now made 4 Mad Max movies, and we screened 2 of them. We screened the most recent one, Mad Max Fury Road, which is 4, and then we showed The Road Warrior, which really is called Mad Max 2, but American audiences hadn't seen Mad Max 1, so they just called it The Road Warrior in America, so that people would think it was a totally new movie and not be confused. And weirdly, that's 2, so we showed 2 and 4, and they are the most similar of all 4 of them. In a weird way, Fury Road feels like an elaboration or a variation on The Road Warrior, but they are totally different and totally enjoyable on their own. They are apocalyptic car movies, and George Miller, the director, has said that he was a doctor. In fact, he is a doctor. You never take that away. So Dr. George Miller, before he got into filmmaking, was in the ER doing his residency, and all these Australians would come in, because he's Australian. They'd come in with these horrific car wounds and car accidents, and he would just say, what is it about man's obsession with just taking it to the limit in a car and then getting destroyed, getting devastated? And that got him thinking about the apocalypse, and that got him thinking about car movies. And that's where Mad Max was born, was his ER experiences with really horrible car accident victims coming in and him having to try to fix them up.
I love The Road Warrior, and there's so many things to love about it, but I'm going to cut straight to Fury Road, because I think Fury Road is top 10, maybe top 5 of the best movies of the decade. It is an action movie on a scale that is sometimes uncomparable to what it pulls off. And the more you learn about the behind the scenes of it, the crazier it seems of how they pulled it off. Because I feel like the trailer, what is it, 2015?
Yeah.
The trailer dropped for this, and like there wasn't a lot of hype. People were like kind of excited about it, and I was a little bit excited about it, but I thought it would just be like a CGI romp as per usual. And then I genuinely think it was one of the best theatrical experiences. There's a shot in Fury Road that I think is the ultimate litmus test to will you dig this movie, which is this giant caravan of cars in the desert, and the camera swings around to these cars that are rigged with weapons and spikes, and then you get to a car that's got a bunch of people playing drums in the back of it, and it sweeps around to the front to this deranged, like disfigured blind man playing a guitar in front of a mountain of speakers, and as the camera settles on this massive wide shot, he shoots fire out of the end of his guitar. And at that point, if you're not in, like, that's the thesis. And at that point, if you're not in, then, like, I don't know what else you want from a movie.
The doof warrior.
The doof, yeah. Who's a great character.
I don't have anything else to say about these movies except what Daniel's saying, which is incoherent. You know, like, I would just sit here and say how much this movie rules.
Pretty amazing. I, you know, just like Daniel said, a visceral stimulation of sound and action. And again, like the car aspect of it, the way they were modified, they were all hot rods and just hot rods gone mad, sort of the creative just jumping off that the director or whoever did to design it. It's just amazing. I didn't really know how, like you'd said, Daniel, how the earlier movies were connected. I think I've seen the original Mad Max, but don't know what was between that and Fury Road.
The first Mad Max, Miller has said he actually had a horrible time on the movie. It was his first film. He just had to fight to get it made, and he didn't really realize what it was until the very end. And you can feel that in the film. It almost feels like the apocalypse is about to happen. They're trying to keep society together in Mad Max.
Sounds a lot like these days, sort of.
Yeah, you feel it teetering. Yeah. You feel society teetering. Then in Road Warrior, it's done. Like, the apocalypse has happened. And Max has lost his family, and he's just with his dog in a car in the outback, and he doesn't want to get emotionally attached to anybody, and he ends up helping it's like Seven Samurai. I actually realized it's Seven Samurai. He ends up helping this village of people that live in an oil refinery, and then it has an amazing car chase. Thunderdome, we find Max a little further in. There are pockets of society now, and he ends up, you know, he has this really tortured story with kids, because he lost his child, and suddenly he becomes responsible for all these orphans, and he goes to this town where they have Thunderdome. And then in Fury Road, which is kind of a reboot but not really, it's like he's crazy, and he now is just, there's no hope, and yet he suddenly finds himself a sidekick to these brides of this guy, the Immortan Joe, and it's this patriarchal society that really treats the poor horribly.
Fury Road feels like almost the progression where it's almost like the world is at a second apocalypse.
Absolutely. You're like way deep into it. And Max is like clinging to his sanity, and there's nothing, nothing, nothing. It almost brings us full circle in the conversation. What was that term you used about chopped and customized? What was that?
Yeah, that's exactly what a lot of those cars were done. And whoever designed that aspect of it was definitely connecting back with the hot rod culture. A lot of those could have been hot rods back in the 50s, but they had spikes and flamethrowers and all kinds of creative stuff to them.
And it really is, people always say, like, oh, it's like nothing I've ever seen before. I don't know if there's anything else quite like Fury Road in terms of just this type of thing in a mainstream film that is just this weird and works, in my opinion, works almost 100%.
Pure cinema.
Yeah.
In doing the research for the movie, and this is something I think about a lot, people may know the history of Fury Road. It originally was supposed to star Mel Gibson, and they were going to shoot it in the late 90s, early aughts, and it kept getting pushed back and back and back. When it finally got greenlit, it wasn't really tenable anymore to have Mel Gibson, so they recast with Tom Hardy. But what ended up happening was, even then, it got pushed back another year because there were these torrential rainstorms in Australia. They were going to shoot it in the outback, and suddenly the outback was full of flowers. And so then they were like, the apocalypse can't be like full of these wildflowers. So they ended up setting it in Namibia in South Africa. But what was interesting was, with that year, they tested out every stunt with old wrecks, and the stunt coordinator ran every stunt on a computer. They then weighted the cars with dummies and did the stunts with dummies. They then did slow runs with the real actors. They then brought in engineers for all the exigency plans. And then they went to Namibia and they shot it. And the thing that I thought about was, no surprise, they prepped the heck out of that movie. And the reason that it's once in a lifetime is they spent 4 years testing, and then shooting. And I think the lesson I got out of that, if you want to be an action movie maker, and Daniel, I think you and I have talked about this, I want to make some great action movies. I love action movies, but you cannot go into an action movie thinking every day is going to be, you know, interesting and dynamic and exciting. You have to go into making an action movie like you're designing a rocket that goes to Mars. They're going to be real boring days. You're going to do a lot of math. You're going to do a lot of testing. You're going to do a lot of tests. And the reward will be that we're talking about Fury Road and everybody now considers it the greatest action movie. But that reward is when the movie's done. When you're shooting movies like this, you just have to take a breath and be patient.
A traditional painter, and I'm trying to figure out how I can do my paintings and scan them, make them digital, and then add animation to them or other kind of doing other interesting things to them. So it's just kind of, I don't know, kind of a state-of-the-art thing in the digital community at the moment, which I find pretty exciting. I do a lot of storefronts. I'll give you my website is davidtindallfineart.com. And I'm on Instagram as Tyne Artist, T-Y-N Artist. Trying to kick out a lot of interesting oil paintings of storefronts. And I do a lot of New York city scenes and that type of thing.
And I think, Dave, you did a great painting Daniel showed me. I was really humbled by it, of the Vista.
You're in that painting. Yes, yes. You're actually in the painting. I thought Connor might be in there too, but I don't think he is in that one.
Unfortunately, no.
No. I have to do another one.
You know what we should do? If you don't mind, Dave, Daniel, if you have a photo of that painting, that might be our cover art for this week's podcast.
Sure.
Or we'll include it.
Cool.
If that's okay.
Oh, that's wonderful. No, I love getting it out there. And thank you for letting me be a part of this today.
It was awesome to have you.
I spent the weekend rewatching the first two Bill and Ted movies in preparation for Bill and Ted Face the Music. Bill and Ted was like my childhood friend groups and I's like thing. We love Bill and Ted and I haven't revisited it in a long time. And not only do they hold up very well, the second one more so than I remembered. The second one is like kind
of
wild.
I think I like the second one more. I think it might be one of the best comedy sequels of all time.
I dug it as a kid, but now I'm like, wow, this is sort of the insanity of like pitching like, oh, the sequel to this time travel movie is going to be...
They go to hell.
They die and go to hell. Yeah, it's wild.
Well, speaking of 180 days of lockdown and feeling good, I watched the RNC, which I'm not going to actually talk about. I was playing some video games this week, Fall Guys. I won one, felt good about it. Big thing is I got back into playing God of War, the 2018 game. I like thinking about, especially movies, video games, and comics, like eras and sort of history and how you can look at things. And this console generation is coming to an end now. And I think 2018 had the epitome of what this console generation will become known for, which was this generation figured out how to tell stories, not just in ways that mimic movies, but in ways that are fully of a game. I want to figure out a term like game-o-matic. That means the same thing as like cinematic or novelistic, but for games, if that makes sense. And I think God of War, Red Dead Redemption 2, and Spider-Man that year were all just kind of incredible. God of War... I would be interested in like seeing you react to it, Craig, because specifically there's a lot of father-son themes. It's about Kratos, who is this old Roman god now living in hiding as the Norse gods are now in power, has this son who he doesn't really know, and their mother has just passed away, and it's about them taking her ashes to the highest mountain in all the realms, and things getting in trouble, and him having to deal with his son and his legacy and the things he's done in his past. Yeah, and I stream video games. You can see me be the gamer boy at twitch.tv/ConnorCruz.
I believe we're about 64 days out from the election. I was just thinking about two things. I'll keep it real simple. One, again, is I think I'm going to just call it hashtag 10 to turn. If you have a better name for it, please write me. I'll totally take it. But if you know 10 people who are in the swing states, the important states, now every state's important. Everybody should vote. I live in California, and California has tended to go one way. But I respect everybody's point of view. I respect everybody wanting to get out there and vote.
I would just say also there's things that aren't just national that you could vote on, even if your state is nationally going to go one way or the other.
So I just tend to turn is, you know, the states that are really in play here at the executive level, it looks like Minnesota, Michigan, mm-hmm. where Dave is, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Arizona, Georgia, possibly weirdly, Florida, and then a little less so, but still closer than you would think, Iowa, Ohio, and Nevada, I believe. So I would just say to folks, it would really be important for our country and our democracy that whatever the result is, it's declarative. And nobody could really say, oh, it didn't happen, or oh, it was too close. It would really be nice for it to be like, this was the voice of the people. And I would really encourage everybody who can vote, if you're 18 years or older, please do vote. I'm not going to tell you how to vote, but just know that your voting matters. And I looked, and everyone still has plenty of time to register.
Get on it, though. I know specifically I'm trying to help some friends back in Texas register. And there are ways to do it by mail, but it takes about 30 days, and that's after they accept it. So look into that now. But if you Google register to vote in your state, you're going to find a ton of resources that are going to be very easy and to follow.
If you're a young person, and that could be whatever, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and you're comfortable with this, polls are going to need poll workers, and you get paid, and it's, you know, a day of work, and you get trained, and, you know, it's not right to ask older folks or at-risk folks during this time of COVID to be manning the polls, and a lot of those folks probably won't be manning the polls this year because of COVID concerns, and what I don't want to see happen is polling places shut down because they don't have the poll workers. Thank you, guys.
Very good.
Yeah. I thank you, Dave, for being on the show. Let's give it up for Dave Tindall.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for
And
being.
That's it. All right, guys. I really appreciate it. Thank you all. And I will see you all in a week.
Bye. Thank you.
Take care, guys.
Bye. Me. Yells that.